There is no shortage of words written or spoken about D.W. Griffith. In fact, with the exception of Thomas Edison, I think that Griffith is the first person in this show so far that I can say that about. Heaven help you if you're looking for information on Cecil Hepworth, George Albert Smith, Elvira Notari, or most dreadful of all, Roberto Roberti. And while there is plenty written about Edwin S. Porter and George Méliès, and thankfully more written all the time about Alice Guy and Max Linder, in my experience, none of them hold a candle to D.W. Griffith. The man gets a whole chapter in my personal favorite general film history, and his work is at least mentioned in pretty much every other book or class on the subject of film history ever. I personally own a biography of just his early career. D.W. Griffith is the most famous and most infamous of all of the early filmmakers. And while watching his movies, you can see why, in his own day, so many people praised his skill as a filmmaker. At their technical best, Griffith's films successfully implement virtually all of the innovations we've seen so far in our journey through film history. He deftly wields George Albert Smith's close-ups, the editing of Méliès, Williamson, and Porter, Pastorone's massive crowds and fluid camera, Alice Guy's masterful directing of actors, and the sheer scale of the Italian epics, creating, in his most famous and most vicious film, a story that was both grand in its scope and remarkably coherent in its plot, especially compared to other epics like Cabiria. But despite his technical virtuosity, Griffith's legacy is one of real, measurable harm, a legacy of violence and hate, and one of changing the world for the worse for millions of people. We have been dancing around the life and work of D.W. Griffith for a while now, because I wanted to make sure that you had context for his films and were familiar with the technical innovations that made his movies possible. But today, that changes. This is the 23rd episode of The History of Film, D.W. Griffith.
No story ever written for the screen is as dramatic as the story of the screen itself. Tonight, we write another chapter in that story.
Childhood is an important influence on everyone, but it doesn't always have an obvious impact on the kind of creative work people do later in life. For the subject of today's episode, it definitely did. So we are going to start at the earliest parts of Griffith's life and follow it into the film career that he would become so famous for. David Wark Griffith was born on the 22nd of January, 1875, in the southern United States. More specifically, he was born in Oldham County, Kentucky, near the Kentucky-Indiana border. His origins were much more humble than he would later lead others to believe. According to his official biography, published in 1920, Griffith was Southern gentry, his family supposedly descended from Welsh kings, and his childhood home a colonial plantation. This, unsurprisingly, was untrue, a complete fabrication. Griffith grew up relatively poor, one of seven children raised in a wooden farmhouse. Griffith's mother was Mary Perkins, a deeply religious woman, and his father was Jacob Wark Griffith, a former colonel for the Southern Confederacy during the United States Civil War and member of the House of Representatives? That's weird, but I guess it's true, and D.W. was very proud of it, as many children would be. Jacob Griffith gained the nickname Roaring Jake during his time with the Confederate Army, and he would pass on tales of his exploits for the Southern cause to his son, David. Some of these stories were at least a bit dubious, or entirely mythological, but all of them would be influential to the young DW. It's easy to imagine young Griffith listening, enraptured, to the stories his father would tell him of the war and of life before it. It was here that he would begin to develop his ideas about race and U.S. history, all of which would be warped and incorrect. It's also worth noting that while Griffith idolized his father, the actual character of the man was not unimpeachable. Jacob Griffith had a penchant for excessive drinking, and according to family, would talk and drink with his friends for hours, while his wife and children labored on the farm in the heat of the day, by the end of which, he would be falling down drunk. While D.W. was only 10 years old, tragedy would strike his family. The young Griffith's father would die of old injuries sustained during the Civil War. In a few years, the family would move off the farm into Louisville, Kentucky, where ultimately they would live in poverty. Griffith would blame his home and childhood hardships on the Civil War itself. These stories passed on by Jacob Griffith to his young son and misplaced blame for family hardships, by all indications, are where Griffith would develop his most well-known trait. Deeply held Southern regionalism, as expressed by unrelenting racism and historical revisionism. In Louisville, Griffith's mother would need help supporting their family, so he left behind any dreams of formal schooling. Despite the end of these formal opportunities, Griffith still read voraciously. Through a combination of frequenting his local library, working at a bookshop, and listening in on reading circles, Griffith schooled himself, developing a particular fondness for the romantic poets and great melodramatic novels of the 19th century. He would never outgrow the rather simplistic set of Victorian values he learned to love by reading these books, and this appears to be the origin of Griffith's other most remembered quality, his patriarchal nature. As Dixon and Foster note in A Short History of Film, Griffith viewed women either as icons of virtue or maidens in distress. At this same time, he was also developing his ideas about what made stories exciting, and that was melodrama. While other directors would eventually seek for subtlety in their work, Griffith would always prefer mustache-twirling villains, faithful slaves, virtuous wives, and heroic husbands. Going back just a little bit, it was while working for the bookshop in Louisville that Griffith first discovered the stage and its allure. Enamored with it, Griffith decided to become a playwright at the young age of 17. There was only one problem. He didn't know anything about plays. So his first step was to learn something about plays. The young man would become an actor. And was he any good? Well, who can say for sure, but probably not really. David A. Cook wrote that Griffith's acting career was probably less of a matter of aptitude than of zeal and of good looks. For the next decade, Griffith would act in dramatic roles across the country, eventually landing lead roles and even acting in Shakespearean productions. So as not to embarrass his deeply religious family, he performed these roles under the name of Lawrence Griffith, thus preventing their connection with what was, at the time, considered a shameful profession. You could probably write a whole chapter of a book about Griffith's life as an actor, though it would likely get a little boring. But that's not what we're here to talk about, so let's skip ahead to 1906, when Griffith marries his first wife, Linda Arvidson, and when he finally succeeds in getting a play published. The new couple was paid $1,000 in royalties for the play, The Fool and His Girl, which bombed hard, closing just 2 weeks after its premiere. Never one to be deterred by anything, including, shall we say, poor critical reception, Griffith boldly embarked on the literary career he dreamed of since being a teenager. Over the next year, he would publish a handful of short stories and poems in popular magazines, but alas, there were no riches, and he didn't publish another play. It was in this situation that a friend would make a recommendation, which, when taken, would change the world. To pay the bills, he said, Griffith should try working for the movies. Griffith took the advice, wrote a scenario for a film, and attempted to sell it to Edwin S. Porter. Porter rejected the script, but liked the look of its writer, and so Griffith was hired to be a film actor for the rate of $5 a day. Griffith's first role was the lead in the 1907 film Rescued from an Eagle's Nest. It's a movie we already talked about back in episode 13, so we won't go over it too much here. Remember, it's the silly story where an eagle carries off a baby and Porter's character has to have a fist fight with the eagle puppet? We've actually talked about a few of Griffith's movies on the show so far, so this will be one of several that we bring up in today's show, but don't discuss the plot of in great detail. After finishing his work for Porter in Rescued from an Eagle's Nest, Griffith's services were no longer needed at the Edison Studio, and so once again, he was without steady income. But he must have found his work at the movies at least somewhat appealing because he began to seek employment at other film studios. It was in this situation, in 1908, that Griffith presented his credentials to the studio Biograph, co-founded by none other than W.K.L. Dixon, and was hired as an actor and a scenario writer. The sources differ a little bit on the exact financial situation of Biograph Studios in 1908. Most say that the company was in dire straits, unable to compete with Edison and the trust that it had not yet joined, while at least one other says that Biograph's successful competition with the trust required it to expand its operations to meet demand. In an odd twist, it doesn't really matter, because either way, the studio needed new talent to keep existing, which is what allowed Griffith to get his job, and a mere 1 to 6 months later, was made a director. The promotion landed him a $45 a week plus royalties contract, and the first movie he made was The Adventures of Dolly. The Adventures of Dolly is a lot like other movies we have seen on this show. It has its roots in movies like Rescued by Rover, the chase films of Gaumont and Pathé, and a well-spun story directed by Alice Guy. I can't say what, if any, of these movies Griffith had seen, but many of the conventions we've already seen established are apparent in this movie. The plot of The Adventures of Dolly goes like so. A happy couple and their daughter are by a stream, when a man characterized as a Romani attempts to steal from the mother. The father of the little family bravely beats and repulses the would-be thief, who leaves bitter. The villain plots his revenge, returning to the family and kidnapping the little girl, stowing her away in a barrel. As the kidnapper flees from the scene of the crime, he stows the barrel, with the little girl in it, in the back of his wagon. While crossing a river, the barrel falls from the back of the wagon and flows downstream. We watch it float further and further down, through dangerous waters and over a small waterfall. Eventually, the barrel winds up back at the banks of the very same river that the movie started at. The father shows up just in time, rescues his little girl from the barrel, and order is restored. The end. That is a very Griffith movie. It's got the whole list. Happy family, dangerous minorities, unlikely coincidences, and plenty of melodrama. And that's pretty much it. It's not an innovative film by any means, but to give credit where credit is due, it's better than some movies being made at the same time on a technical level. Perhaps its most impressive quality is its convincing simulation of real space. The shots, when taken together, actually give audiences an impression of the geography within the story. And for a first movie, especially one from 1908, it does show that the now 33-year-old Griffith had a budding understanding of the medium of film. The Adventures of Dolly would also be personally meaningful for Griffith in more ways than one. His wife would be the female lead in the film, and it was also his first collaboration with cameraman Billy Bitzer. While Bitzer was not the cameraman on The Adventures of Dolly, he would help Griffith choose his shots, and would later become his personal cinematographer. I think it's particularly important to keep this in mind, because especially with people like D.W. Griffith, we tend to talk about movies like they were made by one person, but they, of course, are not. I've said this in this show before, and I will say it again and again, film is an inherently collaborative art form. In the Griffith-Bitzer partnership, there is no doubt that Griffith was the leader, but there is also no doubt that any advancement in film technique credited to Griffith should also, at least to some degree, be credited to their partnership. Griffith's time at Biograph was productive, to say the least. During his tenure with the studio, he would direct more than 451 one- or two-reel films in just 5 years. That's almost two movies a week. Because of this incredible output, and because, amazingly, the majority of these movies survive to this day, we'll be talking about very few of them here. One of them that we will watch is A Corner in Wheat. It's a strange little movie that has a decently cinematic ending for 1909. A Corner in Wheat is a movie of social consciousness. Poor farmers sell their wheat crop to a corrupt businessman who has a monopoly on the wheat trade. The businessman then increases the price of the wheat to line his own pockets with the extra and to throw lavish parties. Later, while touring his mill, the rich wheat baron falls into a grain elevator, where he is crushed and suffocated by the wheat that enriched him. In the middle of his demise, there is a flashback to an event that must have happened earlier, when the suffering poor group up into a mob and demand bread at a fair price, only to be repelled by the police. We cut back to the now very dead businessman, who's fished out of the wheat and mourned by his wife and their wealthy friends. The final shot of the film is the poor returning to their plows, doing what they must to survive in a world which is now a little bit more just than it was before. The use of the flashback here is the film's major technical innovation. Even though the sequence can be a little bit confusing the first time you watch it, it really is a step forward. In classic Griffith fashion, he didn't invent the flashback, which we have already seen as early as Ferdinand Zecca's History of a Crime, almost a decade earlier. But in A Corner in Wheat, the flashback effect is achieved by a simple cut, rather than a double exposure. The method employed by Griffith is used much more commonly in cinema today than the one used by Zecca. It is also an interesting narrative choice, because the rich businessman isn't remembering what is happening in the flashback. He wasn't there. Instead, the scene is thematic and narratively tied to what is happening to the businessman at this part of the story. I don't know if Griffith was the first person to use the flashback in this particular way, but I can say that I did find this use of it to be impressive. Next on the innovation list is another film we have already looked at, the 1911 movie Enoch Arden. Because we've already covered the plot of this movie in some detail back in episode 15, I won't do so again here, but I will take a little bit of time to talk about its technical accomplishments. In Enoch Arden, we see Griffith, and may I add movies in general, beginning to move away from reliance on long shots and proscenium framing. Instead, we have a lovely mix of medium shots, long shots, and close-ups that add a lot of visual spice to the picture and lets the actors have more subtlety in their work. Enoch Arden also employs impressive parallel editing to add dramatic tension to its story, cutting between the shipwrecked husband and the long-suffering wife. And now I must repeat, Griffith did not invent parallel editing for tension. Instead, he adopted it quickly and used it well, and his movies were better than average on a technical level because he did this. David A. Cook, the writer whose book I talk about all the time, actually ascribes all of the innovations that I just described in Enoch Arden to a 1908 Griffith film called After Many Years. Apparently, Griffith remade After Many Years in 1911 and called that remake Tina Garden. Over the next few years, Griffith would develop an improvisational filming style, writing out the general plots of his movies, but keeping the actual shooting script confined to his own mind. In order to finalize what they would actually make, he would run his actors through rigorous rehearsals as they all worked out the fine details of the production together. These years would also be defined in part by the word short, short films, short turnaround times, and short budgets. People who worked with Griffith described the sweatshop nature of it all, and how he was at least somewhat displeased with it. While working in the sweatshop, though, he would eventually employ people who would become some of the most famous actors of all time, including Florence Lawrence, Mary Pickford, and Lillian Gish, and they would make some entertaining movies together. Take The Unseen Enemy from 1912, where we would have a rad close-up of a gun poking through a hole in the wall. There is tremendous intercutting for suspense, and we see the lovely early film acting of Lillian and Dorothy Gish in their very first film role. In The Musketeers of Pig Alley, also from 1912, we have either the first gangster film of all time, a whole new genre, or, as writer David Shipman would say, just another cops and robbers tale, and a confused one at that. I'm inclined to agree with Shipman here, because I did find it confusing. We could go on, there are literally hundreds of films we could talk about after all, but our time with Griffith at Biograph is quickly drawing to a close. To finish up, let's have an overview of the innovations ascribed to Griffith from this period before we enter into our discussion on the sole feature film that we are going to talk about in this episode. Just to reiterate, in all actuality, Griffith invented very little, though many people, including Griffith himself, would claim otherwise throughout film history. What he did do is explore ways to use techniques already created to increase the emotional impact of his films. He used increasingly diverse shots, which is why his later short films at Biograph are so comparatively easy to watch. I would rather watch The Unseen Enemy 4 times than The Loves of Queen Elizabeth once for this reason. The dreaded proscenium framing that defined the look of early film through film to art was thankfully mostly dropped by Griffith by 1911. In many of the movies we've talked about so far, especially special effects film and film to art, editing has either been a magic trick or a means to an end, an unfortunate necessity of telling stories using film. Griffith was one of the people, and let me be clear, one of the people, who were beginning to see editing as a feature of the medium rather than simply a component. These are remarkable achievements, made by someone who really was a leader in filmmaking at the time, though not the demigod that he would later lead others to believe he was. It would also be wrong to omit that Griffith's racism was already apparent in his years working for Biograph. In the relatively few Griffith films in which black characters appear, they're almost always played by white men in blackface. I'm not an expert, so it's possible I'm overgeneralizing, but from what I've seen, black characters in Griffith's movies are undereducated servants, whose chief positive quality, if they have any, is undying loyalty to their white enslavers, or if, after the Civil War, their technical employers. When we cover The Birth of a Nation, we will see that this is still the case, but with many more negative qualities ascribed to black characters, all of which are rooted in racist stereotypes. Griffith and his collaborators kept releasing these 1- and 2-reel films into the year 1913, but his heart was wandering. As we know, by 1912, film to art had proven that audiences were ready for longer, more complex movies, and by 1913, Quo Vadis would take the world, the United States included, by storm. Griffith wanted in on the prestige and the sheer dramatic potential of these longer movies. I don't know the boardroom drama that allowed it, but eventually Griffith got approval for an $18,000 budget from Biograph to make the over-hour-long film Judith of Bethulia in 1913. Griffith would end up spending more than twice his allotted budget to make the movie. The essential plot of Judith of Bethulia is about as simple as the plot of a one-hour movie can be. The city of Bethulia is under siege, attacked by the armies of the vicious ruler Holofernes. Cut off from access to food, water, or trade, the innocents of the city begin to starve to death. An influential widow, Judith, decides to take action, and so she disguises herself as a concubine and goes to the enemy camp. There she seduces Holofernes, and when they are alone, despite the feelings she has developed for him, she decapitates the tyrant. She returns to the city, decapitated head in hand, and is greeted as a hero. Without their ruler, the armies of Holofernes retreat. The end. While that is the plot of the film, it is not the movie. The movie has another love story of a young couple, which is much harder to follow, and lots of spectacle. The sets and costumes are really amazing, and I was shocked to see just how good they are, how lavish they are. The walls of Bethulia feel like they stretch up into the sun, and the sets of the city are filled with interesting and beautiful architecture, like sky bridges stretching from building to wall. The scenes of battle are massive, filled with cavalry and infantry clashing outside of deep wells in grassy fields. Soldiers attempt to scale the city walls, lifting massive ladders, and are repelled with people throwing what looks like real projectiles. The crowds in the city are overwhelming and claustrophobic. And through all of this, there is plenty of melodrama, though not done as well as in some of Griffith's earlier, shorter films. But with all that praise, we should also recognize that there are parts of the movie that just don't work. The story of the young lovers is at least a little muddled, and it doesn't exactly feel like it works with the A-plot of Judith and Holofernes. Another thing that doesn't work is the dancing girls. Like every biblical epic ever put to film, there are dancing girls here. And in this movie, it seems especially out of place. Holofernes orders all of the captured and enslaved women in the camp to perform the fish dance, in which they huddle up, lay down, prop themselves up on one arm, and wave the other arm wildly into the air, which, I suppose, is supposed to be sexy? If so, I don't get it. The acting in the film lacks in some areas, and the attraction that Judith feels towards Holofernes seems forced. But even taking these issues into account, I would say that its spectacle holds up at least as well as Quo Vadis, though I personally like Quo Vadis more. Okay, I'm probably being a little bit hard on Judith of Bethulia. David A. Cook called it the greatest American film made before 1914, and Louis Jacobs has written that even if Griffith had done nothing more than Judith of Bethulia, he would have still been considered a sensitive and outstanding craftsman. And obviously Judith has a huge place in film history. It was one of the first feature films ever made in the United States, and when using that as context, it's hard not to think of the movie as pretty amazing. And while Griffith surely felt that making a feature film was a major accomplishment, Biograph didn't share that notion. The higher-ups at the studio were not pleased with the expense of Judith of Bethulia, and so Griffith was told that he had been promoted. Their star director was told that he would no longer make movies, but oversee the filmed art style productions that other people would make for the studio. There, it seems, it was thought that Griffith could not cause the expensive trouble he was known for while actually directing movies. So, rather than take the job and the insult, Griffith walked. He would leave Biograph at the end of 1913 and take with him Billy Bitzer and virtually all of the people who he had worked with at the studio. Over his 5 years with the company, Griffith iterated on and popularized the techniques of cinematic storytelling that had developed before him. He directed hundreds of movies, cultivated a loyal group of collaborators, developed an influential personal style, and had become a major name in the American film industry. Now free from Biograph, in 1914, he would take everything he had done, everything he had learned, and massive loans to begin work with an independent production company on the movie that would define his life's work and his filmmaking legacy. Next episode, we tackle the most infamous movie in film history, the movie that continues to make the world a worse place. It was the film that was commonly cited in its own day as being the most popular and influential film of all time. Next week, it's The Birth of a Nation. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The History of Film. This was supposed to be a short one. I thought, I'll be able to do this in 20 minutes, and getting it out on time won't be a problem. Obviously, that was not the case. Well, next episode, I know, won't be short, so I can't have it out for you on Monday. Instead, you'll have a bonus episode, which I hope will provide valuable context for The Birth of a Nation and what we've been talking about regarding Italian futurism and Italian fascism. And then it will be the next Monday that we will all get together for the movie that is the most terrible of the early silent period. There was a whole subject I wasn't able to talk about in today's episode. I just didn't have the time or the knowledge to make it happen. And that is Griffith's portrayal of American Indians. I ended up removing what little I wrote about it from this episode because the scope of it was getting too large and I would never be able to get it done. But we will talk about this because it is enormously important. I'll be making a series of episodes about the portrayal of American Indians in film and the movies that have been made by Indigenous filmmakers, both soon and throughout this show. I just have to figure out precisely when and how, because after about 1910, film history explodes in geography and complexity. My favorite fact that didn't make it into the show this week is that Griffith's rehearsals were bonkers. Lillian Gish recalled that when she and her sister first met Griffith, they just sort of started participating with the actors that were rehearsing. By the end of rehearsal, Griffith had pulled out a revolver and started firing it into the air and began chasing the sisters around. Gish later recalled, "We thought we were in a madhouse." This, I believe, became the short film The Unseen Enemy that we talked about in today's show from 1911. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at historyoffilmpodcast@gmail.com. Hearing from you has been a really meaningful experience for me, and I deeply appreciate that you take the time to write me. On the subject of taking time, please consider taking a couple of minutes and leaving a review for this show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. That more than anything will help the show grow and helps me to know what you like about it. Thank you so much for listening, and join me next week for another exciting episode of The History of Film.